This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. As regular listeners know, this is the 50th anniversary year of Reason. We got started in 1968, way back when. And today, I'm very happy to be talking with Virginia Postrel, a longtime editor-in-chief, pretty much from the very late 80s until the new breaking of the new millennium. Virginia, thanks for talking.
Sure. Nice to be with you.
Well, we're gonna talk a little bit about some of the stories that you think defined your tenure, which, if I'm remembering correctly, dates from 1989 until 2000, until the end of 1999. That's about right, right?
My actual tenure, if you want to know the specific date,
yes,
and a resume,
please.
I became the editor-in-chief, or as I called it, the editor, but that
right.
People get confused about that, at the beginning of July in 1989, and I left in January 2000.
Okay, and you had been at the magazine for a number of years before that. When did you start?
I started in the summer of 1986, so I worked for Marty Zupan.
Yes, who we're also talking with in this series. Give me, before we get into your editorship, which among other low marks, I mean, we'll get to the high points. You hired me as well as, a good chunk of the people who are still at Reason, so you have a lot of explaining to do on that score. But what was it like to be at Reason in 1986? Can you lay out where was the libertarian movement? With small L, and where was the magazine when you first started working here?
Well, to answer the question literally, where was the magazine? Because that's part of the story, is the magazine was in Los Angeles. It had just moved to Los Angeles from Santa Barbara. And this is important because when I was in college, we can talk about the whole story,
sure.
But when I was in college, I developed the career aspiration to be the editor of Reason Magazine.
Wow.
However, this, aside from the fact that that's sort of a crazy aspiration for anyone to have under any circumstances, it was particularly crazy because Reason was located in Santa Barbara. And when is your life ever going to take you to Santa Barbara?
I think unless you're retiring or you're you're Fess Parker, TV's Davy Crockett,
yeah.
It never is, right?
Or Oprah.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So this was particularly unrealistic, and I didn't, it was just kind of a dream. I mean, I didn't proceed in my life in any sort of strategic way to become editor of Reason. I became a business journalist. And then in 1986, my fiancé,
mm-hmm.
I got a job offer at UCLA, and I was working for Inc. and writing about small business, and I also wanted to try my hand at doing some political writing and just other things. So I worked out a deal with my boss to write half-time for Inc. and half-time freelance, and that was my plan to do when I moved to Los Angeles. But then at that very moment, Reason had an ad saying, we're moving to Los Angeles and we're hiring an assistant editor. And so I was like, wow. And so I applied, and unbeknownst to me, I was the first journalist to ever applied there. So
right.
It wasn't as hard as I thought it might be to get the job. And so I started at Reason right at the time that Reason moved to LA, which was an exciting time for the magazine, but also a time of transition because some of the people who had been working for the magazine and the foundation moved to LA and others didn't, or just moved long enough to help make the transition. So they had been hiring people like me. And it was a very small staff. We had a couple, you know, I think two, we had two assistant editors, and a production person and an art director, and Marty, of course. And there may be people, Bill Kaufman was in DC as the DC editor, and that was a new thing. And one of the things that I remember most vividly is we were very early adopters of desktop printing. But because we were also cheap, we didn't use Macs. We used IBM compatible machines, some of which had been donated by various tech donor reason people. And we were doing essentially programming like it's very similar to programming HTML, except if you couldn't see whether it worked or not until you sent it out to an expensive place to get what we call VLOXes or the print special printouts that you
this is
wax on the back.
Yeah, this is taking
so
me
this
back.
Is an 80s.
Yeah. Yeah, this is like true desktop publishing, and it was probably like a fake version of PageMaker or something like that.
Oh, this is before PageMaker.
Even before
this
that,
was,
yeah.
This was very early. It was a program called SuperPage, and so we were real pioneers, and I always laugh at the idea that, oh, the young people, they know so much about tech because they've grown up with it. No, they actually know nothing about tech because they've grown up with it, and they just assume it works, but they have no idea how.
And I assume that you must have had with, I mean, that was when Paste Up was kind of literally Paste Up, although I guess it was Wax Up, right? Because you would, and stuff would fall off the boards between shipping and like getting to the printer some of the time, that type of
Well, we never had that happen.
Well,
there were
that's
a lot of last-minute dashes to FedEx at LAX, you know, to get the board sent out to the printer as opposed to just transmitting them.
Well, so what, you know, I'm looking online at Reason.com. We have a cover gallery, a gallery of all the covers. And, you know, there's one of the issues, this might have been before you started in 86, but there's an interview with Eldridge Cleaver. Russell Mean shows up, the American Indian activist. Stories about, it looks like William Weld and I'm trying to remember who the other, was it Jeb Bush, who were a new type of new type of Republicans? Or no, it's Jack Kemp, right? And Bill Weld were new types.
I don't know. I don't remember that. The Weld story I remember was from later.
So what you know? What was big in the libertarian world in 1986?
Well, I remember one of the first things that I learned about because I came to Reason that I wouldn't have known about otherwise was asset forfeiture. I remember editing an article about the DEA that got into issues of asset forfeiture, and I believe we also had a separate article on asset forfeiture, which I had never heard of, and is, of course, something that people are still concerned about today, where instead of, you know, you don't even have to charge, you don't have to convict somebody, you just charge the goods with the crime and take them.
Which leads to those incredible court cases that are like, you know, the U.S. government versus $56,324 in cash or something like that. Yeah,
exactly. So that was, I don't know whether I would say it was big in the libertarian movement, but that was something that, and you have to realize also, Nick, I am not a libertarian movement person. I never was. I was a journalist who had libertarian or classical liberal views and was interested in intellectual journalism, and therefore Reason was the best match to my view. But in terms of intra-libertarian movement stuff, I was and am pretty much clueless.
Which saves you a lot of pain, right? I mean, because I the same way, I mean, my involvement with the libertarian movement began with reading Reason. So I suspect yours was similar then, where you, I mean, you're interested in the ideas, but not so much who stabbed whom in the back in, you know, 1974 or something.
Right.
Like
and
that.
I was much more oriented toward the sort of scholarly side of things, the mm-hmm. University of Chicago School of Economics or Law and Economics or those kinds of things, as opposed to the Libertarian Party or mm-hmm. the various backstabbing that might have occurred at, you know, yeah. long before my time, between the Cato people and the Reason people, or the Inquiry people and the Reason people,
right.
which was a short-lived libertarian magazine. Anyway, this was in the sort of later years of the Reagan administration. Mm-hmm. And so one question was, how good or bad had that been for libertarian ideas? And I think it was, in libertarian movement circles, sort of fashionable to emphasize the negative. I tended to see more of the positive, but obviously it was a mixed bag, as anything in the actual political world right. is always a mixed bag. But this, I would say, was like a better mix than most.
So intellectually, what was hot? Because, I mean, this with the Reagan kind of revolution, I guess, cresting, although in 86, there was still a lot of major stuff to come in terms of immigration reform and some tax reform. But, you know, was Friedman, was Milton Friedman really riding high then, or the Chicago School, or, you know, what was hot intellectually?
Well, Milton Friedman was very still, you know, rock star, definitely.
Right.
And I remember we had him at a recent banquet at one point. I would say that one of the new ideas in that period, I'm not sure what the exact date on it is, but was Richard Epstein's book, Takings. That
right.
was a relatively new book in that period. And the sort of concept, there's a specific legal argument about the Takings Clause of the Constitution in that book and how it should be applied much more widely so that people were compensated in any cases where the government took something of theirs or subtracted value from them in order to benefit other people. But there was also a more general sort of reconceptualization of the sort of libertarian thinking on economic matters, which was this idea of an exchange. What was permissible for government was when there might be a public good, say, that you needed to fund, but people needed to get back value for what they were being taxed for.
Right.
So that, and I'm sure Richard would correct me on a million things here, but this is sort of my understanding of what was the sort of the idea, that it's not that taxation is wrong per se, it's more an anti-redistribution argument. And that was this, an interesting new idea. And there was also a lot of thought that this line of reasoning might lead to greater protection for property rights in the regulatory arena, whether land use in particular, as opposed to just saying, no, the takings clause is just for, say, if the government wants to build a road and exercise them in a domain, it has to pay for the property, which is the traditional sort of narrow view of the takings clause. And I remember we had a little seminar about that book at the office where we all read it, and we had a law professor come in and lead us through it and introduce us to legal concepts that made it a little bit easier to understand. So that was an idea that was kind of hot at the time.
Do you remember what your first major story for Reason was?
That I wrote or
yes.
that I edited?
That you wrote.
That I wrote. Yes. I wrote a story about property rights and religious freedom. And actually, come to think of it, this is very topical.
Yeah.
And the argument, it was about there were some sort of land use regulation cases. There was a case of a woman who didn't want to rent to an unmarried couple. And it was basically about rites of religious exercise or freedom of conscience mm-hmm. coming into conflict with regulation that was framed in terms of, oh, it's not religious regulation, it's just economic regulation. And of course, not a big fan of economic regulation either, but just showing that how there are these inevitable conflicts. And mm-hmm. I think that piece, and which just resulted from basically me, I was just clipping articles that were interesting. We used to do this literally. We would mark articles, and our research assistant would clip them. And I would just clip articles that caught my interest and stick them in a drawer. And then I went through them and found a pattern of these kinds of cases. And I ended up doing this article. And I think that article and some of the attention that it generated in the religious communities of various, I mean, it got covered on the Christian Broadcasting Network.
Oh, that's great.
So helped to lead to, I can't remember what it's called, this religious exercise protection act.
Right, Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
And which was very, passed with a very uncontroversial act when mm-hmm. it passed, even though it threatened to infringe on the rights of zoning boards to keep churches and minions and various mm-hmm. other mosques out of their neighborhoods, as well as issues perhaps ultimately leading to controversies over cake baking.
Yeah, which, and now, of course, our descendants will be arguing about cakes, not over religious freedom, but probably over, like, carbs and sugar content or something. And once those has your thinking on that changed at all in terms of, say with like the contemporary cases of cake baking or of Hobby Lobby getting a religious exemption, as a privately held for-profit corporation getting an exception?
Right.
The standard libertarian line is that, it's good to minimize the ability of the government to regulate certain things. Is that still your basic take, or where are the places where, when it comes to anti-discrimination, when should the state actually have the right to force people not to discriminate?
Well, one thing that I've come to a greater understanding of, oddly enough, through some of the research I did on the history of hotels when mm-hmm. I was working on The Power of Glamour, is a deeper understanding of the common law of public accommodation. And this is a very, very old English common law concept, which says essentially if you put out a shingle saying that you're serving the public, you have to serve the public, subject to behavioral and norms and stuff. I mean, it's not a complete blanket thing, but the sort of Jim Crow, whether they're public or private, discriminations in things like hotels and restaurants, cut against centuries of common law.
Wow.
And so that's something that I don't think most people understand. I certainly didn't, even though I was very, being a white Southern liberal mm-hmm. from that sort of background, I was very sympathetic to those civil rights laws, but much more than many libertarians who saw it in a more abstracted form. But this was kind of a revelation to me, and it also explains why when I read a lot of works by Frederick Douglass, who was a very in many, certainly a classical liberal in, mm-hmm. in many, many ways. And there's a new book out that, from Cato about him. And stuff. And he was extremely offended by refusals of hotels to accommodate him. And it wasn't just a personal offense. It was a sense that that cut against a fundamental liberty interest, that shouldn't happen in a free society. That he, and I think there's a truth there. There's a truth about freedom to travel and mm-hmm. all of those kinds of things that libertarians need to take very seriously. So that's one thing. Another thing has to do with history. And a lot of libertarians like to imagine that we can start with a clean slate and treat just sort of have, I call it libertarianism as algebra, you know, that you would just figure out a few premises and then say what society should be like. But that's not how society works. And we're all embedded in history. And the history of race in America is much more than just the history of slavery. And so I definitely think that the civil rights acts are much, you know, are more than minimally justified. I think they were. Right. Now you get to something like the cake baking issue, and my feeling my view on that is one that will strike many people, maybe less libertarians than the general public, as very silly. But it is this. If you are a bakery, put out your shingle, say we bake cakes, and a gay couple comes to you and says, we want you to bake our wedding cake, you have to bake them a wedding cake. Mm-hmm. Except if they say, we want you to write on the wedding cake, best wishes, Mark and David, for a long and happy life together. That's speech, and you can't coerce that. So that, in other words, that they have to sell you a generic cake, but the state should not be able to compel them to put specific words on it. I know that sounds ridiculous.
No, it's well, and it seems like that might be a way through, you know, this until we stop caring about this issue. It's always kind of fascinating.
Right, exactly. And the truth is that what we're talking about here is a highly competitive industry with mm-hmm. lots and lots of people in it who will sell you a wedding cake. And so it basically is a symbolic issue. It's not on the one side, people who have, whether it's religious or otherwise, traditional sexual morality views that say, you know, homosexuality is bad and they don't want to sanction it. You know, they see it as insulting to say that people can come and demand that they get a cake. And then, of course, gays see it as insulting to say that somebody can discriminate against them and say that they're bad. So you've got basically two sides that believe that they shouldn't be told that they're bad.
Right.
And two sides that believe that the other side is bad. But really, these people don't have to have anything to do with each other, because there's lots of bakeries and there's lots of customers and you can just sort it out. It's one of the less practically problematic cases, far less troubling than if somebody wants to, you know, discriminate in, I don't know, renting to people to whether it's unmarried couples or gay couples or whatever. You know, that's a much more problematic, in a practical sense, kind of situation than the cake thing.
And curiously, we hear much less about that, too.
Symbols make people very upset.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you don't really hear about that anymore. People being...
Well, yeah. Well, as the watchers of Silicon Valley might analogize, I don't know if you watched that show, but the
very
last
much.
Episode had a gay Christian dating site in
right.
subplot where the fact that the guy was Christian became a big that he was
yes.
outed as a Christian became a big deal. So as the watchers of Silicon Valley know, in the places that have really, 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 really tight rental markets, those places tend to be the sorts of places where you would not discriminate against gay couples or unmarried couples. Anyway, the places where you might choose to discriminate are places where there's plenty of apartments to rent.
It is, so. You know, this type of kind of thick argumentation and like embedding things in history and context and intellectual traditions, obviously that's a hallmark of your work, both, you know, at Reason and at Bloomberg View, where you're a columnist, when you were writing a column at the New York Times for years, in your books like The Style of Substance and The Future and Its Enemies and The Power of Glamour. You obviously brought this also to the magazine. So let's talk about your editorship. You started in the middle of 1989. Obviously, you were absolutely part of the reason why the Berlin Wall collapsed a couple of months later. What was
absolutely,
your...
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, if I've learned nothing from you, I've learned that, you know, correlation implies causation, right? So, but what was your vision for the magazine? And you know, and this is, I think some listeners will know, I was hired by you in 1993, I think late 1993. So it's, you know, it's about 5 years later, but I had been reading the magazine before and during your tenure. And talk, so, you know, in a way, you know, I'm a figure in your landscape, but how did you conceive of the magazine? What were your goals for it? And how did you think about it as, you know, this window or catalog of a particular vision of the world that was going to be coming out each month? What were you trying to do with it?
Well, I wanted to make it, it had already long ago moved from being a really narrow movement magazine to being something broader, but I wanted to make it broad. I wanted to have a big tent to think about issues of free minds and free markets from. Mm-hmm. And I wanted it to have good writing and good reporting. And I also wanted every article to have something new. And the something new could be a new idea. It could be new information, new reporting. I didn't want it to be the same old, and that is very hard when you have a specific political lens. It's much easier if it's, you know, the New Yorker, or, I mean, they have a sort of a general political take on the world, but they can write about
right.
anything. And so you don't want to have every article be, and that is why free markets are good.
Right.
That is why we should have freedom of speech. That is,
yeah.
why, you know, that is why drugs should be legalized. You don't want to have everything read like that. And so how do you make a magazine that is a great magazine or a good magazine that is also in this intellectual political tradition, and then how do you get people to read it, and how do you, so that was part of it, and related to that was being part of a general conversation, being part of the policy conversations and the intellectual conversations that took place in all the magazines of this genre, whether it was on the left or the right, or all there's an array of these different magazines or editorial pages. And I also wanted Reason authors and editors to become much better known. There had been, the previous idea had been, you work for Reason magazine, you write for Reason magazine, you edit for Reason magazine, that's what you do. And don't go writing for other people, because that's stealing from the company. Mm-hmm. And my view was, no, PR, go write op-eds, write stuff, and you know what, you can even keep the money if there is any.
Yeah.
And we need to be doing much more of that. So that was a big thing. But it was very, very difficult. I'll come back to one other idea, which only occurred to me very late in my tenure when I was interviewed. But it was very, very difficult because we had very, very little money.
Right.
We never had money the whole time I was there. I was starved for resources. But one thing that I realized fairly early on was that most of the freelance articles we got were terribly written. Not all of them. We can talk about some really great writers that we had who were freelancers, but they were terribly written, and the editors had to do a lot of work to get them into publishable shape. So wait a minute, but all the editors were good writers. So one of the tricks was to find ways to have and we could make time for the editors to do reporting. Mm-hmm. So one of the tricks was to find ways to have more staff-written material that could be reported over a longer period of time, that would be better written. And so that was one of the things that I tried to do. And then getting back to this idea that came to me much later when I was being interviewed. Somebody interviewed me and wanted to know about Reason as a contrarian magazine. That was what they thought my concept was. And I said, no, that's not my concept. Yes, we end up being contrarian sometimes, because what's the point of saying the same thing everybody else is already saying?
Right.
People have heard that. So that's often a way to make an interesting story. But my concept, which is very different, by the way, from your concept, was that Reason was a mainstream intellectual magazine with an unusual point of view. So that it was not, we were not freaky weird people. We were not trying to shock the bourgeoisie. We just happened to have these views that were somewhat unusual. But our standards of journalism were the same as the standards of writing were the same. We lived in the same sort of society and world of people. We were not some kind of underground weirdo publication.
Right.
That we just happened to think you were wrong about a lot of things.
Well, and you know what? You also, worked to establish or kind of document and establish the intellectual genealogy of Reason. You know, you mentioned people like Richard Epstein and obviously Milton Friedman and whatnot. But I mean, that's one of the things that I think I know. I still look back at the at your tenure, and it's kind of great. I mean, like the people, both the people you had writing for the magazine, but also the history. You mentioned Frederick Douglass just a little bit ago, that these ideas, while they might not be as popular or as widely known, a kind of contemporary liberal or conservative point of view, but that they have real roots, which was very comforting. You know, I know as a reader, like where you're like, I feel like I don't really have a past or something. And Reason, I think, helped provide that.
Yeah, I think there's a split here. And this is where sort of my view of the tradition in which Reason is or was embedded, and say Brian Doherty's view, and Brian, I hired him, he worked for me,
right. Yeah.
Are different, which is that I view Reason, or I I wanted Reason to Be would be a part of a long and deep and broad and complicated classical liberal tradition, stretching back through thinkers, not just 20th century thinkers like Friedman and Hayek, And I would include Coase, who in a recent interview said he's not a libertarian, but he is a classic.
It's not the only thing he's wrong about, right? Yeah.
Yeah. That stretches back not only through those kinds of thinkers, but also through the Scottish Enlightenment people, Smith and Hume, and back at least to Locke, you know.
Right.
And that also includes theorists of checks and balances, and is not primarily an anti-New Deal tradition, and definitely not a tradition about blowing up the government.
Right.
Literally or figuratively, is a tradition about how to sort of make things work for liberty and prosperity.
So
and
it's
inquiry
it is to check or disperse power. I mean, to decentralize power and to enable individual. I mean, it's really an Enlightenment tradition, right? Of classical liberalism and limited government.
Yeah.
As opposed to anarchism.
Right.
If I can add, this will probably not come as a surprise to you, but over the past few years, I partly because, like you, I had never been in the libertarian movement until I joined Reason. I never really thought about it in these terms, but over the past few years, I mean, I understand that libertarianism, I think best understood, is a form of liberal limited government theory, and that it's very, very different than anarchism. And I find myself getting more and more annoyed and in more and more arguments with libertarians who say they're libertarian, but they're really anarchists, but for some reason they don't want to admit that. And then they chide me for not being anarchist, but I'm like, no, I'm just for limited government. I'm not anti-government. I suspect that that's your influence. I'm unloading it now. I'm blaming you for that. But
you can blame me for that if you like. There is this question of, and the other thing is, I remember one time after I had left Reason, but it was in the early 2000s when I was blogging a lot, and I got in this really nasty fight with Jonah Goldberg because he called me a nihilist.
Right.
And he said, like, you can dish it out, but you can't take it, which is probably true. But but this, I am so not a nihilist. I mean, I am like this moralistic, earnest person, you know, and I am. It was so wrong. That's why I got so upset.
Well, I think that was, he called you a cultural libertarian along with myself and Andrew Sullivan, and that we were nihilists because he accused us, and obviously all three of us are different in many significant ways, but that it didn't, we were saying that it didn't matter. Like one choice was as good as the other when it came to lifestyle or politics or whatever.
But it's so strange because I don't believe that.
Yeah, now I know very few people who do, especially you. Yeah.
I mean, I've become more sort of that way as I've gotten older, actually, contrary to the stereotype. It was so, so incorrect. However, you know, I have been known to call you a nihilist, Nick.
I can live with that, you know, because, you know, really, what does it matter? You know, what do words mean in the end?
So that was my vision of Reason. Mm-hmm. I feel that it didn't work. That actually didn't work. There's a management thinker, I mean, he's long dead, but I know only secondhand through my husband, who is called Stinchcomb. And he had this theory of that every organization is imprinted with the circumstances of its founding and the sort of culture. And this was in the business context, and that it's very, very hard for companies to change in ways that fundamentally depart from that. And I think that's true to some extent of the libertarian organizations that were founded in the late 60s, early 70s, essentially, regardless of the year of their founding, they come out of the early 70s. And that even one like Reason Foundation that has as strong a sort of pragmatic incrementalist, what Tyler Cowen and Alice Tabarrok would call marginal revolution, small steps toward a much better world, Bob Poole kind of imprint, because he was always having to argue against, they were under constant, obviously I wasn't there, I was in elementary school, but, and then I was for McGovern and this little baby socialist. But they were always having to defend themselves against these sort of Rothbardian anarchist types. They were always feeling on the defensive as opposed to feeling like we're right and you're wrong and you should be defending against us. That sort of warped all, that experience has warped all libertarian organizations that came out of that that period in a way that regardless, that they tend to take those assumptions as the default, even when they're arguing against them. And it's very hard. So unless you're constantly pushing in other directions, that becomes the default.
Right.
That's probably not what you want to hear.
I find it. I'm not sure it is. I don't know that it means we're doomed to failure, but I think it's actually a pretty strong read of of the libertarian movement and of institutions, you know, like Cato and Reason and CEI and a couple of other places, and a lot of the personalities that are, even if they came to these organizations much later. There's a lot of truth to that. Let's talk about, some of the big stories. Obviously, you were at Reason and you helped, and it's funny that you said like it failed to become a mainstream political magazine of ideas that was taken seriously. And I can remember, I'm trying to remember the exact context for it, but I remember we had some blurb that we used to run that said something like Reason has elbowed its way into the conversation. And it seemed to me that you achieved that goal spectacularly by professionalizing the journalism, by forcing all of us who work for you to really do, top level reporting and writing and being serious and thinking through, not just, like this was under your tutelage. It was certainly not like Allen Ginsberg, first thought, best thought. It was like 20th thought, a constant iteration process.
Yeah,
which was
I always say I was raised by mean editors, and then I passed that on.
No, but so what were some of the big stories that you either wrote yourself and or edited, like where you were, really like, okay, we've got something here that you are, you knew you were really contributing to a national discussion of ideas?
Well, we certainly did a lot of stuff on immigration in the mid-90s, including two great pieces, cover stories by Glenn Garvin, that were finalists for a national magazine award for public service. This was in the period where, not terribly unlike today, except the difference was that National Review was run by people who are now considered alt-right. Peter Brimmel. And they were constantly harping on a very sort of racially charged immigration, restrictionist position, which is a little, I mean, National Review still has a restrictionist position, but it's changed in tone a lot, mm-hmm. and is focused primarily on tightening controls on illegal immigration, whereas back then it was mostly about let's dramatically cut the levels of legal immigration. So we were writing about both. So that was one thing.
Before we go to the internet for a second, but with immigration, because this is, and you know, I mean, immediately to look at the, you know, your arc as editor is to see how many issues you were early on in identifying as important and pushing on, and that are still around. But with immigration being one of them, what was the basic reason take under you? And I know that you, particularly with Peter Brimelow, who at that point I guess was writing for National Review, was working at Forbes. Now he is the doyen of vdare.com, and all, you know, a true alt-right kind of nativist site. But
one important thing, when he wrote for Forbes, he did not write
yes.
about immigration.
No, that's for sure. Yeah.
he did excellent work for Forbes, but
yes.
It was not about immigration.
What is your basic argument for, and if I'm remembering correctly, I mean, it was mostly, I mean, you're basically, if somebody wants to come here and they, you know, they should be able to work and live here. And, you know, as long as they're not a criminal, right?
Well, in a perfect world, yes. In a mm-hmm. practical world, and I don't think you can assume away the welfare state.
Right.
My view is that we should just have much, much higher and much less nationally arbitrary immigration quotas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my personal view. So,
yeah.
However, when we were writing about it, a lot of what we were doing was trying to point out, first of all, the history, the fact that immigration history in the U.S. is a lot more complicated than simultaneously more complicated and simpler
right.
than people make it out to be. That you hear people say, well, my family came legally. Well, yeah, because back then anybody could come unless they were Chinese, you know.
Right.
And then there was a period where even after the restrictionist period, it was fairly easy to come if you were from within the Western Hemisphere
mm-hmm.
before 65. And so there's a lot of complexity things. I mean, people never ask themselves, well, wait a minute, how come after 65 it was so easy for family reunification, for people mm-hmm. to claim family reunification and have all these Latinos? They must have been here already. How did
right.
they get here? So that was one thing. But a lot of it was really about, okay, you say you want these things, these new regulations, because you think they're going to hurt other people. But if we start policing if everybody has to have ID to get a job and all of these things, we're going to have all these checkpoints, we're going to have all these things, it's going to affect people who were born and raised in the United States. It's going to affect you. It's going to affect me. You know, I can join the DAR, you know.
But yeah.
It's going to affect all of us. This is not about other people. It's going to affect businesses, the ability to hire. It's going to affect whether you can have someone to take care of your aging parent. So this notion that it's not about them, it's about us, was and is a theme. And part of that is the nature of the you know, what sort of country do you want to be mm-hmm. is another part of that. But a lot of it is just this practical appeal. Let's work through the numbers. Suppose we have a big database of everybody who is legal to hire in the United States. Suppose it has this small error rate. What happens then? That
right.
sort of thing.
Which is, and I remember one of Glenn Garvin's pieces was about kind of national ID cards. And in the mid-90s, there was
yeah.
still there was still, you know, and I think he was citing data, which doesn't seem to have changed very much. But if, I mean, if you assume a 1% error rate in this thing, we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people,
right,
you know, in a regular period being inconvenienced. But it's also, back then, it seemed like there was pushback against the idea of a national database for workers, whereas now, even the Gang of Eight, you know, they're all like, oh, yeah, well, we have to have.
Yeah,
it's odd, right, the way that both, you know, changes and becomes normalized. And I can remember certainly after 9/11, I guess, conservatives who had been very, you know, who were still talking about how Social Security cards had become national ID cards and this was evil. And now you can't get them off the idea that, you know, we should practically have chips implanted in us.
Yeah, I think 9/11 changed a lot of things, but I think it changed that specific debate a lot of ways. And the other thing is, before 9/11, it was basically a certainty that we were going to have a major positive immigration reform under George Bush, who loved Latinos and immigrants and, you know, and all of that stuff. And that was really true. I mean, really, but then when 9/11 came, because these Saudis came across the Canadian border, we're now going to crack down on Mexicans and Salvadorans who are washing dishes. You know, but it was all associated. So, and that changed a lot. Yeah.
And it was also, I guess, oddly, too, the Democrats in 1996 were very anti-illegal immigrant in a way now that they've tended to flip.
That's not really right. What happened is in 1996, both parties were split.
Mm-hmm.
So there were Democrats.
Yeah, because Clinton campaigned against illegals, I know.
There was a split in both parties, and this is one reason it was one of my sort of touchstone ideas in The Future and Its Enemies, so there was a split in both parties. What's happened is that the Democrats have unsplit.
Right.
And partly in response, I think, the Republicans are not nearly as split as they used to be either, although there's still some Republicans who are pro immigrant and sort of anti-massive enforcement against illegals. I think traditionally a lot of conservatives had this very sort of, I guess, almost like Burkean concept that we should have these laws and we shouldn't not enforce them, but we should accept a certain level of leakage, particularly in certain parts of the country, because of history and economics and not wanting to have the sort of overreach and bad effects of a massive crackdown. And I think conservatives have over time become persuaded that, no, this is a principle that we have to stand on, that you have to have law, and so we have to enforce every law to the maximum, which of course they don't actually believe, when it comes how many of them drive.
How much do you think immigration is then the kind of anti-immigration push? And I wouldn't say it's, you know, specifically racist, and certainly not in a kind of 19th century way, but that discomfort with people coming from, you know, like that the immigrants today are different than the immigrants before World War II, and that this idea that, you know, going back to a kind of Burkean sensibility, not Burke himself, but that, you know, Mexicans, Indians, Chinese don't have the same traditions and are not going to fit. They're going to change the culture too much. Is that driven mostly by, you know, kind of anxiety about the global economic order or the way, change seems to be happening at a pace that people are uncomfortable
with? I don't think you can talk about this in national terms. You have to talk about it more regionally. I mean, one aspect of today's immigration is that parts of the country, the South primarily, that experienced essentially no immigration from the 1900 to 1965.
Right.
When I was growing up, the only immigrants that I knew were Scottish, and that was because we were Presbyterians. But I didn't know very many of them, and they were all married to native-born Americans. So first of all, you have immigrants in a big part of the country that never had immigrants before. That has no, my grandparents came from Italy kind of stories. So and that has different effects. Some people, the immigrants freak them out more because of that. Some people, they freak them out less. But that's one thing. That's very different from the people who are in Ohio and Michigan and imagine that these immigrants are totally different from my uneducated, heavy drinking, bar fighting ancestors who were Catholics in a Protestant country, I do come at this not only as a classical liberal, but also as, an old stock American from the South. And so I laugh at people. I mean, I think it's like, you're Irish and you're saying that these Mexicans are changing the country, especially if they're in California and Texas, please. So there's that. So you have these different regional things. And then you do have this big swath of the Southwest where it's just, saying there shouldn't be Latinos in the Southwest is like saying there shouldn't be blacks in the South. It's like this bizarre denial of history and geography. And I think most people in the Southwest at some level accept it, although you have these strange things where, like in California and Texas, there isn't huge anti-immigrant sentiment, but in parts of Arizona there is, and I don't really know why that is.
Yeah. So let's move on to you were about to mention the internet as another big story that that you were covering was major under your term as editor. How did you approach that? Because that was, it's funny now to look back at it and it was so obvious, but it was unfolding in ways that people were denying that networked computers mattered well into the late 90s, really, it seemed.
Right. Yeah, so I have a fun story about that. So in January 1991, we ran a cover story about a crackdown on Steve Jackson Games, which was this online gaming company. And that came to us because we were plugged into the tech world through our basically readers and supporters. Around that time, so that was in January, so this would have been in late 1990 because the thing was at the printer. John O'Sullivan had just been named the new editor in chief of National Review, and the Orange County Register editorial board, the largest libertarian newspaper in the country, invited me to come to lunch. They had John O'Sullivan come and invited me to come down to have lunch with them. And so we're talking before the lunch, and John O'Sullivan says, "So, what do you have in the works?" And of course, I don't want to tell him anything that isn't a done deal because could steal it, right? So I say, "Well, we had this article that cracked down. And I have to sort of explain what the internet is." Network computers, people playing the FBI and blah, 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 which was, by the way, what led to the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the first computers privacy and Freedom Conference, and I met my Godwins through that. Anyway, so I tell John O'Sullivan about this, and I say, and so what do you have up? And he says, we have a 200th anniversary of Edmund Burke, the Reflections on the Revolution in France. And I thought, okay, there's the two magazines. One looking forward and one looking back. Of course, I love history, and I write a history column for Reason Now. And I think it's very important. I think the best way to understand the future is to understand the past. But we were looking ahead to the internet, and we did a lot of stuff over that period. And I also was writing for Forbes ASAP in the late 90s, which was a tech publication, and writing a lot about the early internet days. But I remember in about 1993, we were hearing from a number of Reason supporters, hey, you need to be on the internet. And I was like, okay, well, at least I know what the internet is, but I don't know what that means for the organization. I don't know. I have this email account, because earlier the same people had said, you need email. So I had this CompuServe account, and my handle was something like 71502.2391. So I met with this guy in Silicon Valley, this really smart computer guy, Mark Miller. And I said to Mark, people keep saying we need to be on the internet. Well, what should we do? Should we start a bulletin board? What should we do? And Mark says, there's this thing called the World Wide Web, and it's going to be big. And this was before the Mosaic browser. So basically he was saying, hold off. In a year, there's going to be the World Wide Web, and that's what you're going to want. And in fact, that was true. And we were very early on, had one of the first websites, and got Reason.com through something called Electronic Newsstand. We originally, when we started our website, we thought Reason.com wasn't available. So we registered ReasonMag.com. We used that. Then we realized that we actually owned Reason.com, but we just didn't realize it because we had done this thing with this thing called... anyway, so that was the story of the internet. And of course, it was a that and the fall of the Soviet Union are the two big stories of this period, not necessarily the ones we devoted the most attention to, but they were the two big stories of the period, and we were ahead on the internet, and was very important.
What you had a really good record with. You mentioned National Magazine Awards, and Glenn Garvin's pieces on immigration policy were finalists for that, as well as a story by Edith Efron about Clarence Thomas, and Jacob Sullum had a piece about opiophobia, about pain doctors being kind of harassed by the DEA for handing out too much pain. What were the other stories that really stand out, or topic areas that stand out for you?
Well, I was gonna mention Jacob's story from I think it was January '97. We seem to do well with January issues. In a just world, that would have not only been a finalist for National Magazine Award, but it would have won. Because I read all the stories that were the finalists in that category, and that was the best one. Yeah. And it also probably holds up the best. But, the Atlantic one, because
once you get the final
category. I actually had the experience of judging the National Magazine Awards. I was in the first round, they get about 35 people, and you start with pairs of people who read the same group of articles, and then decide which ones, if any, to pass on for the next round of reading. And I was paired with a woman from Us magazine. We couldn't have been more different, but we were entirely agreed about what was good and bad. And the same was true in this group of 35 people. We all agreed on not only on what the finalists should be, but all but one of us agreed on what the winner should be. Although that wasn't up to, then we put the finalists up to the group of big shots who would decide on the, and lo and behold, our favorite did not win. Something from the New Yorker won. You know, and I have a feeling that might have happened with Jacob's story. I don't know.
It is amazing to think, though, that that not just that story, and he, you know, just a couple of months ago actually wrote, you know, kind of 20 years later, I mean, 21 years later, he wrote the same story almost, except the situation in many ways is worse now, which is both a testament to your prescience and you know, to the longevity of these issues.
I know. I was a little depressed when I saw that story. I mean, it was great that he did it, but
this is not progress. Yeah, what is a story or topic area that you think that you were covering strongly that has actually, you know, where your analysis or reasons analysis has kind of won? Are there any that come to mind?
Well, let me think.
Yeah, no, because I'm thinking trade, you know, free trade is under attack in a way that, I mean, you fought a lot. I mean, there was a lot of talk about globalization because there was the whole anti-WTO crowd that you pushed back on, but free trade is under attack, immigration.
When I started, everybody was, I mean, well, some of this goes back into my early tenure when Marty was editor, but, you know, when I started at Reason, we were... we were terrified of the Japanese.
Right. I think we've won that argument, right? There's not, it's less and less.
The one thing that I think I wouldn't say won, but more won than lost, is on the issue of biotech regulation.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was much more of a moral panic about biotech in the late 90s and early 2000s, particularly around issues about cloning and anything that would affect human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there was a there was an effort to criminalize, not merely regulate or outlaw civilly, but put scientists in jail if they did what was called therapeutic cloning.
Mm-hmm.
That was basically, we were saved essentially by 9/11. I hate to say it, but that was the Bush administration suddenly developed other priorities. And on the FDA, I mean, having Scott Gottlieb at the FDA, and he was the moderate is positive. And unlike most Trump appointees, he's not receiving a lot of hate. I think a lot of people find his views to be fairly sensible, as it turns out, even though he's loosening up and even though we still see big pharmaceutical companies portrayed as routine mass murderers. I mean, not mass murderers, deliberate murderers on TV shows. So I think on that front, there's been some positive.
Yeah, for sure.
Extensions. And I think we're going to see a whole other wave of it. When CRISPR is, you know, I talk about the internet was the big story. Then CRISPR is this big, still covered mostly in the tech press kind of technology that's going to change all kinds of medical things and maybe even get rid of malaria in the near future.
Well, that's actually, I hadn't thought about that. That's fantastic to even envision. I mean, where if you could eradicate malaria the way that we've eradicated polio, I mean, that's beyond a game changer.
And the way the way it would be eradicated is by making it so that the mosquitoes can no longer carry the malaria. You alter the mosquito. There's a way to do it. I mean, it's just people start to get paranoid, but bus, alter the mosquito so they can't carry the parasite. And that would be fantastic. That would be an enormous boon to humanity.
Yeah.
And that may very well happen in the next 10 years.
Do you feel like, and I think this may be my own depression speaking more than anything related to you or even the world at large, in a way, well, thinking about the 90s and, you know, there was a moment because of the end of the Cold War, certainly, but also the surge in tech and the internet. And, you know, there was a real sense that great things were possible, and not in that kind of national greatness stuff coming out of the Weekly Standard that you regularly and I think effectively invade against. But, you know, the idea that people coming together in voluntary, you know, in businesses and research and new ways of living, you know, that massively wonderful things were possible. Do you feel like there's still that, or are we more great things are still happening, but it seems like we can't knit together a positive vision of the future?
Well, obviously 9/11 changed a lot of things. It changed, the terrorists have won.
Right.
At some deep level. They didn't win in the sense that they didn't get what they wanted, but they certainly imposed enormous costs on us, or we imposed them on ourselves. But I think it was traumatic in a very deep way, and then followed by the deep recession, the Great Recession. So that sort of 1-2 trauma makes it much more difficult to figure out how to be happy, or how to be,
yeah.
Or you be happy in your personal life, but how to be happy about the state of things. And,
right.
And then that has, and then those traumas then lead to people looking for narratives that they find satisfying, which often are narratives about how all the other people are horrible. Mm-hmm. And so we're in this moment where there's just this marathon of hating your fellow citizens,
yeah.
Or your fellow Americans, residents. And that is, I think, a big part of it. And part of this, I would say, I wrote articles that had all the pieces in them about things that would happen on the internet or mm-hmm. even geographically, in terms of the long tail, what's now called the long
right.
tail, people finding each other, people sorting geographically. And I only saw the positive sides of those things. I didn't think about how they might exacerbate tensions or create bubbles of self-reinforcing truth, because I am, first of all, generally an optimistic person about the direction of things. And secondly, because I myself use those sorts of things to sample other people's bubbles. So
right.
I and also because I'm conscious of the bubbles that existed in the good old days when mm-hmm. we had three big networks and everybody believed the same thing, except they didn't, because I can tell you I was living in South Carolina where people believe different things from you in New Jersey.
Right.
As I learned
so.
When I went to New Jersey to go to
yes.
college.
Yes.
So that, I think, is part of it. Great things are happening, but the world is complicated. I mean, you look at what's going on in China. On the one hand, there's energy and they're doing things mm-hmm. and people and they're still, we think, getting richer. On the other hand, compared to the 90s in China, things have been moving backwards on the political front.
Right.
I have a piece, it should be up on Bloomberg today, about because there was a weird question in the Facebook hearings where Mark Zuckerberg was pitched what was supposed to be a softball about sort of only in America could this happen. He goes, well, mostly in America. And I'm like, well, this couldn't happen in China. Well, China has some strong internet companies. Anyway, I start with that and I talk about this idea of American exceptionalism, and there is, it isn't an accident that these big companies only developed in the US. Mm-hmm. And even though there are some really big internet companies in China, and there's some really great technology in China, but there's also problems. And I talk about a case where basically the government just shut down a very popular service not because it was saying bad things about the government, but just because it seemed to be allowing people to create uncontrolled networks of people. And this is something that is troubling.
if you're an autocracy, right? That's kind of problematic. Would you say then that possibly not fully accounting for some of the negative effects of globalization, of the march of technology to empower people, the rise of the internet and affiliated technologies, that might be, that was a failing, or that was something that you either got wrong, or that might be too strong a word. But
okay, the quote, negative effects of globalization, is that I don't think we missed. I mean, I don't think I missed it. Everybody knows that when you have these things happen, some people benefit and some people lose economically, and that I don't think is anybody's surprise, and I don't think we ever neglected that.
Right.
It was just, the argument is, on balance, it's better, and that people can really trade. What I think that we missed were effects that are more in the psychological and cultural realm.
Mm-hmm.
And partly that's because we never imagined the rise of social media. That mm-hmm. happened later, and we never. Another thing is, when I left Reason, one reason I left Reason was that I was sick and tired of being in a position where people were constantly asking me why the magazine couldn't make money, and treating it, and donors and board members and others just treating it like it was no good because it wasn't profitable.
Hmm.
And applying standards to Reason Magazine that they would never apply to, Cato Institute reports or something. So I was tired of that. I wanted to just work in the commercial world where I could get paid. And little did I realize that Reason's business model was the business model of the future. For journalism, which was, you find something that people care passionately about, and you get people, either a lot of middle-class people or a few rich people or some combination of the both, to subsidize you. That was the business model for journalism for the future. I had all the pieces, but I didn't realize that.
Well, speaking of your other ventures, I mean, you're a columnist at Bloomberg View. You also are a columnist at Reason as well. Your books, to touch briefly on them, The Future and Its Enemies, which was that published in 97 or 98?
98.
I mean, because in many ways, that's like a great summation, I think, a synthetic vision of what you put together at the magazine. And it's still, I'm sure you follow it more obsessively than I do, but it's amazing to me how you still see that the binary terms of dynamists and stasis coming up. But people still refer to that as a kind of map for where we are. The style of substance, the power of glamour. Substance of style. Excuse me. I am so sorry. Yes. what are you working on next as a book project?
I'm working on a book whose working title, and I think final title, is The Fabric of Civilization. And it is about textiles, technology, and trade from prehistory to the near future. So it's using the story of textiles to look at the story of technology and trade, and also to look at a lot of big themes, whether it's, so the first chapter is about fiber and also about how humans alter nature. The second chapter is about cloth and about spinning, second chapter is about thread and about spinning and about work. The third chapter is about cloth and about code and math. And so it's this way of basically taking all the stuff I'm interested in and using textiles to weave it together.
Ouch. That sounds fascinating.
Oh,
yes.
In the introduction, I talk about how we have all this. We just constantly talk about textiles and don't realize it.
Now, is this just a way for you to live in a South Carolina of the mind, right? Because South Carolina used to be one of the premier textile states in the country.
Yeah,
right?
It is. And the funny thing is that my family was completely at least when I was growing up, was completely uninvolved in textiles. My father, when I was really little, my father did work who was a chemical engineer. He worked in a synthetic fiber company, but through most of my growing up, through most of his career, he was a polyester film expert.
Oh.
So the stuff that went into microfilms and things like that. So I was not in the tech. I was living in a textile center, but my life was pretty detached from textiles. No, this really came about because over a period of quite a few years, I heard a number of really interesting academic talks about various aspects of textile history or of economic history and history of dyes and things like that. And I just thought, wow, this is so interesting. People don't know anything about it. And it's so central to the human story that it should be told. And a few years ago, I wrote a story, an article for Aeon, the online magazine Aeon, where I put together a lot of these themes. And it was very popular, got a lot of readers, and got forwarded around a lot. And I ended up, through some period, sometime good bit later, working through a couple of different book proposals, and the first of which was more contemporary oriented, and because I thought that would be more saleable. But actually, Basic Books, which ended up buying the book, it said, no, we want more history. So that's what it's focusing on, a lot more history. It's very global. It's because textiles have been a global trade since forever. And very interesting.
Well, that I think it's a good way to kind of summarize. I mean, for me, one of the great debts I owe you is that you have consistently taken things that seem to be either unexceptional or obvious, and then you burrow down into what's going on. I remember, and this would have been for The Substance of Style, I think, or around them, when you talked about like the design elements in toothpicks. Which is just something that most people would not even think about. And, and there's like within that, there's an entire world of history and technology and vision and all of that. So it's do you have, are you still writing this book, or is it, do you have a publication date?
Oh, yeah.
Like that?
I'm trying to finish chapter 2 by the end of the month. So, ideally I would be done with chapter 4 by the end of the month. So we're a little behind.
Okay. Well, fair enough. But we will leave it there. I want to thank Virginia Postrel, longtime massively important editor to Reason Magazine, for taking some time to talk with me today. Virginia, thanks so much. And people can find you, obviously, at Bloomberg View as well as Reason. What is the best website that you want people to look at your work on?
Well, vpostrel.com has everything. So okay. That's
the Walmart.
Either of the others.
Yes.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Okay. Well, thank
you.
Yes. Thank you again for talking. This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.